From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Trump says he knows how to make deals. So perhaps that's what's behind this spate of praise he's lavished on some of the world's despots. North Korea's Kim Jong-un is a smart cookie. Egypt's Abdel Fattah el-Sisi is doing a fantastic job. And Vladimir Putin is a strong leader. Does Mr. Trump really admire them, or is he saying whatever it takes to get them to the bargaining table? This hour on Point in praise of despots and America's foreign policy. You can join us on air or online. Are you worried about what looks like an affinity for despots and tyrants? Is President Trump crazy or crazy like a fox? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Susan Glasser. She's the chief international affairs columnist for Politico and the host of the weekly podcast, The Global Politico. She's the former editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine and the former Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post. Susan Glasser, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Here is President Trump right out of the gate here expressing admiration for the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in an interview with CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday.
A lot of people don't like when I say it, but he was a young man of 26 or 27 when he took over from his father, when his father died. He's dealing with obviously very tough people, in particular the generals and others. And at a very young age, he was able to assume power. A lot of people, I'm sure, tried to take that power away, whether it was his uncle or anybody else. And he was able to do it. So obviously, he's a pretty smart cookie.
Pretty smart cookie, Susan Glasser. In the span of 48 hours, the president said he would be honored to meet with the North Korean leader. He also invited the Philippine president, Rodrigo Duterte, to the White House. Give us a sense of why this is raising eyebrows.
You know, I have to say, it's one of those conversations that's really frustrating in a way, right? Because it's the thing about Trump and the dictators is that it is only surprising that people are surprised. But it is still stunning, right? So it's not surprising, but it's still shocking, I guess, is what I would say. Trump has a very long history, really, if you go back and look at lavishing praise on strong men and people he perceives to be tough guys or big leaders. And this predates, by the way, his interest in running for the presidency. Amazingly enough, as a younger real estate magnate, he traveled to the Soviet Union when it was collapsing in the late 1980s. And you know what? He said he didn't like Gorbachev because he wasn't a strong enough leader.
Saw him as weak. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is a through line that runs across Trump's history and therefore I think needs to be taken quite seriously.
He criticized the Chinese for not having a crackdown before Tiananmen Square.
Well, that's exactly right. And so, you know, again, remember on the campaign trail, he was given every opportunity to disavow his admiration for Vladimir Putin. And frankly, politically speaking, it would have been smarter for him to do so. He didn't. Why? This is something I think we have to conclude that Donald Trump actually believes. And he's a man of very flexible ideology. So the few things that are core beliefs of his, I think, are worth paying very close attention to. So, you know, I'm not surprised. And yet I have to say, I still found it as jaw-dropping as the rest of you when he did issue his invitation to Duterte to come to the White House. When he talks about Kim Jong-un like he's some sort of North Korean Horatio Alger story, you know, risen by dint of scrappy internal maneuvering or something to become the leader. That's not how it works in that system.
So with regard to that invitation extended by the president to the Philippine president on Saturday, Here is, in advance of that, the Filipino president has been accused, we should say, of human rights abuses, of his anti-drug crackdown. He's been blamed for the deaths of several thousand people. So here's White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus talking on Sunday with ABC's This Week, saying that a positive relationship with Duterte was necessary to deter North Korean aggression.
It doesn't mean that human rights don't matter, but what it does mean is that the issues facing us developing out of North Korea are so serious that we need cooperation at some level with as many partners in the area as we can get to make sure that we have our ducks in a row.
So cooperation with North Korea, that's the goal here. Remind us, though, what is happening in the Philippines. I mentioned the human rights abuses, the anti-drug crackdown. With regard to human rights, what's going on inside that country?
Well, first of all, that's a very important country because it's been a very sharp deterioration in Philippines, which has been a longtime American partner in the region. But I want to go back to the Reince Priebus statement because it's worth noting that this is, I think, one of the consequences of having this rookie team that doesn't know much about foreign policy surrounding President Trump and President Trump himself being completely inexperienced in world affairs. If you ask any expert, they will say, no, the Philippines is not, in fact, crucial to American diplomacy on North Korea. And that's just not the case. Now, they are a key partner for the United States in the Asia-Pacific region. No question about that. They've long time been a military base and partner for the U.S. in the region. But nobody believes that they're crucial to the current realm of diplomacy in trying to find a way other than a military solution for pressuring Kim on his nuclear weapons program. You know, the road to that runs through China, almost full stop. And so I think it's a naive foreign policy misstatement on the part of Trump's inexperienced chief of staff that he would have made that linkage. It's so important for people to know that.
That's North Korea. That's the Philippines. Last month, in a joint press conference with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi on April 3rd, President Trump said that he fully supported the Egyptian leader. El-Sisi seized power, of course, in a military coup in 2013 and has been accused of human rights abuses, including imprisoning political opponents and journalists.
We are very much behind President el-Sisi. He's done a fantastic job in a very difficult situation. We are very much behind Egypt and the people of Egypt.
Behind Egypt, the people of Egypt. Turkey's president, Erdogan, is coming to the White House in mid-May. Help us understand the concern about Trump's outreach to Turkey and to Egypt.
Well, I'm so glad you brought those countries up because they are really, I think, great examples. The Duterte thing came as a surprise, but in fact, Trump has been a longtime praiser of Erdogan in Turkey and Sisi in Egypt. And both leaders have presided really just over the last few years in major crackdowns against opponents at home, undermining both the rule of law, freedom of the press. They've been arresting journalists in both of those countries. And by the way, the scale of the crackdowns there, it's even more people arrested than in Putin's Russia, thousands of people since last year's coup or attempted coup in Turkey have been arrested by President Erdogan, including just the other day after he had sort of a referendum that was basically rigged to give him more presidential powers to continue a state of emergency. He went ahead, he banned Wikipedia in Turkey. He banned dating shows in Turkey, and he arrested or removed from their jobs several thousand more police officers after already having a very extensive series of purges over the last year. And so this is a very disturbing trend. Remember, Turkey is a NATO member, had once until very recently aspired to join the European Union. Now its trajectory is distinctly not only away from the West, but away from any vision of democracy that any of us would recognize. Egypt, of course, is really the sad underside of the Arab Spring. We focus on Syria, the horrendous civil war there. Egypt has spiraled out of control in a different way over the last few years, but basically has had a military strongman come to power in a coup. The United States cut off aid temporarily in response to that coup. But even under President Obama, we were criticized for not doing enough to stand up for human rights and the rule of law inside Egypt. Mm-hmm. Now, Trump has taken that to a whole new level of actually praising and welcoming Sisi here. And so, you know, I think the message, again, is this is something different. America has always had to deal, of course, with unsavory regimes around the world. We have to deal with the world as it is, not only as we would have it be. But this represents something just that nobody has seen. Democrats, Republicans, this just isn't part of the American foreign policy playbook to lavish praise on these folks in the way that President Trump has. And by the way, for no apparent strategic gain in many instances.
Let me bring in from Washington Ambassador James Jeffrey. He was ambassador to Turkey from 2008 to 2010 during both the Bush and Obama administrations. He was the ambassador to Iraq from 2010 to 2012, also served as deputy national security advisor for President George W. Bush. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador Jeffrey, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So as a former ambassador, as a diplomat, what do you make of President Trump's outreach to these dictators around the world?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First of all, it's very important to distinguish between Trump's public statements and what this administration does. That's not good. There should be consistency between the commander-in-chief's utterings and the actions of the state. But with Trump, we've seen a significant divergence. And that's in the general category of the unorthodox administration we have. But again, we knew we were going to get an unorthodox administration and a critical mass of people voted for him. And this is the president we have. I don't think he's going to change.
So emerging doctrine, though, an emerging Trump doctrine that building personal relationships with rivals, even enemies, can advance American interests?
That's a different thing than his very public embrace of these guys. Is how do we deal with a situation that the playbook since 1989 hasn't prepared us for, which is near peer competitors, China and Russia and other states, North Korea, Iran in the lead, challenging the basic global security system. And this is something that's new only in the last few years, and it requires the United States to cope with it. And that means coping with both those people who are challenging us, who are by definition dictatorial regimes, China, Russia, and dealing with those handful of states that we have to rely on. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the Philippines are among the handful of really crucial strategic allies. Now, Trump gets it wrong in saying he needs the Philippines for North Korea. That's not true, but he certainly needs the Philippines for anything we want to do in the South China Sea.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Trump's proclivity for heaping praise on autocrats and despots, North Korea's Kim Jong-un, the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte, and Russia's Vladimir Putin. You can join the conversation. Do we need to talk with everyone, regardless of what's going on in their countries? Is there a sliding scale of who's acceptable to speak with? I'm speaking this hour with Susan Glasser, the Chief International Affairs Columnist for Politico, and Ambassador, former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, James Jeffrey. Here's an interview with Bloomberg published on Monday, where President Trump said that he would be honored to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un if it were under the right circumstances, he said. Here's how Press Secretary Sean Spicer defended that statement in Monday's daily press briefing.
He's still the head of state, so it is sort of there's a diplomatic piece to this. But the bottom line is the president's going to do what he has to do right now. He's building a coalition in the region to isolate North Korea, both economically and diplomatically, to get the threat to take that threat down.
Also, White House Press Secretary on that same day, Sean Spicer, said that building relationships with leaders, like with the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte and Egypt's Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, is part of diplomacy, even if the United States does not agree with those countries on human rights issues.
The reason that the president is building an effective coalition is getting results around the globe and reasserting America's place is because he understands the type of diplomacy and the type of negotiating and the type of deal making that actually gets real results for our country. So I think it's not a balancing, it's a balancing act, but the president's getting real results.
Ambassador Jeffrey, there is the White House press secretary saying the president is building an effective coalition. He's getting results around the globe. Do you see a strategy here in the president's praise, his invitation to these strong men? Is he crazy like a fox, or is this just sort of off the cuff admiration?
I see a strategy. I don't yet see success. And those are two separate things. He clearly believes in two things. One is he wants to do transactional deals for global security with both difficult allies and very authoritarian or totalitarian foes. At the same time, he also clearly believes, and here I have to agree with him, that our efforts in the past to sponsor internal reform and movement towards democracy and liberal values around the world have not really paid great dividends. Mm-hmm. President Obama was a great fan of that, and on his watch, things went south in Poland, in Hungary, in Venezuela, in Turkey, as we heard, in Egypt, to some degree in Saudi Arabia, and in the Philippines and Burma. So, and that's not from a want of trying. That's basically because our ability to influence what goes on inside sovereign countries is very limited, in particular when we need these countries either as negotiating partners or as allies to solve problems like North Korea, Syria, or the Ukraine.
So efforts in the past haven't worked. Maybe this is an effort to try something new. I will read you here the tweet from Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, who says, "We are watching in real time as the American human rights bully pulpit disintegrates into ash." What's your response to that, Ambassador Jeffrey?
Well, again, nobody did the bully pulpit better than Barack Obama. What are the results? That's what, as a diplomat, I'm trained to look at. What did this accomplish? After 1989 in Eastern Europe, I can give you the results of a bully pulpit, and they were very positive. But since then, we really haven't seen very much of this expansion of democracy and liberalism, quite the contrary, despite the bully pulpit. So if the bully pulpit gets in the way of doing transactional deals, and in concrete cases in the last administration, Egypt is one, it did, then you have to really reconsider. And that's what Trump's doing.
Let me bring in now from Washington, Ilan Goldenberg. He worked at the State Department under Secretary John Kerry, focusing on Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Now he's a senior fellow and the director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Ilan Goldenberg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Great to have you. Well, Ambassador Jeffrey is saying here, you know, Trump is a transactional guy. What we've done in the past hasn't worked. Maybe he's trying something new here. Sean Spicer saying Trump is building an effective coalition. He's going to get results. What do you see? How are you looking at these meetings, these invitations, this admiration for these strongmen around the world?
Sure. Well, I think with Trump, it's always important to distinguish between what is new and what is old. What is old is engaging with authoritarian regimes that are allies of ours. We've done that all the time. Turkey, Egypt, the Philippines. These are American partners. They should remain American partners. I think what's new and quite frankly unnecessary is the fawning over these dictators, the admiration that he's publicly expressing for them. That just doesn't get you anything strategically. It doesn't get you the types of things that Ambassador Jeffrey is talking about. The only thing it does do is it undercuts America's credibility abroad in terms of our ability to be the quote-unquote leader of the free world. You know, I think we need to be pragmatic in how we push these items and agendas, but promoting democracy will remain on our list of agenda items. It's not number one, it never was number one, and it will never be number one. But, you know, a lot of people around the world who are looking for better governance in their own countries look to the United States as a model. And when the President of the United States is so actively fawning, and in some cases even complaining about his own system and talking about how he wishes it could be more like, some of these other systems, places like Russia or North Korea, it hurts. It hurts those people. It hurts those activists globally. And so, you know, I agree we need to be pragmatic, but we also need to have some restraint in the language that we use and that the president uses when he talks about these.
Here's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley during a press conference at the U.N. on April 3rd, defending President Trump's support of Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, saying that even if the U.S. does not agree with the country's human rights record, that doesn't mean they won't talk to them, especially if that relationship helps combat extremism from ISIS in the Middle East.
We're going to play with whoever we need to play with to defeat that. But we're not going to stop calling people out when we see something wrong. And so I think that we've been very consistent and we'll continue to be consistent. But if the president goes and says that somebody's fantastic, fantastic at what? You know, he wasn't talking about human rights. That's why he didn't say the president's been fantastic at human rights. He didn't say that. There's a reason he didn't say that. But those are conversations that we have as well. That's what you do with friends.
Okay, Ilan Goldenberg, obviously these aren't the norms of diplomacy. Trump falls into a different category. But to Nikki Haley's point, the ambassador, you know, is there value in working with people, even if the country has a human rights record we do not agree with?
Yeah, well, look, I completely agree with Nikki Haley. I just don't think that's how they're executing it in practical terms. I think it's been very clear by what the president has said publicly that he doesn't care about the human rights agenda at all. And so this is how it becomes an issue. You know, human rights has always been an item on the agenda with the Egyptians, even when it was Hosni Mubarak for 30 years. It's never been item number one on the agenda, and it shouldn't be. And we need to have a strategic relationship with Egypt, and that makes a lot of sense. But I think that the problem is that you end up in a situation where the Egyptian leaders don't want to walk into a meeting with the president and hear a bunch about human rights. They don't even want it on the agenda. And so they'll sometimes restrain themselves in what terms of what they do internally to make sure it's not on the agenda. Mm. You know, there's this incentive. They want all kinds of things from the United States. They don't want a headache on human rights. And so in some cases, they pull back. Now, with this administration, the message is we just don't care. And as long as the message is we just don't care, that gives Sisi a free hand to do whatever he doesn't wants to do in Egypt, including a number of things that we would be firmly opposed to and have issues with.
And so, Ambassador Jeffrey, to that point, I guess the difference here is that in previous presidencies, when presidents have made an outreach of this nature, they tended to make a caveat, some sort of public or private warning about the need to uphold human rights and the rule of law. President Trump does not do that.
That's true. And I'm one who's delivered many of these messages and been present when many of them have been delivered. They don't have a real impact. There I would disagree with Alain. Everybody knows we do this pro forma. At times, and Egypt is an example or a bad example, we've actually acted. We limited the shipment or delayed the shipment of some weapon systems because of the human rights record. That is a strategy that can be debated one way or the other, but that's real and people do respond to it. But my feeling over decades of doing this is that people just shrug their shoulders. They take it as pro forma. They know that we're not going to do anything significant to enforce this. And again, the example of President Obama, who stressed this in his public statements and in much of his diplomacy, but the world went the way it went with or without his endorsement. And I don't think that it got very far. My concern with Trump's saying these things is, again, he has a strategy, but he doesn't have success. If these guys that he's talking about are not going to do things for him because he says nice things about them, they will do things for him if he makes it painful for them to not do it or he rewards them in some concrete way. That's my biggest fear with this sort of approach that he's taken. The people around him won't take that approach, but he's the boss.
Gosh, a lot of listeners want to get in here. Let me get first to Eli in Elliott, Maine. Hi, Eli. Glad you called. Welcome to One Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just want to make a couple comments. I mean, I think, you know, this whole conversation and almost every conversation these days about Trump is almost ridiculous. I mean, to try to get inside an empty head and try to ascribe, you know, a strategy. We keep talking about a strategy. The guy doesn't have a strategy. I mean, he is complete. He does not know what he's looking at any given point in time. The only thing he cares about is himself, what the public perception is. And he's quite consistent and predictable in this way. I mean, you could, if you were to say, if Rosie O'Donnell were to say tomorrow or today that she thinks that Donald Trump is a smart guy, all of a sudden, the last 20 years of attacking her would disappear in a second.
You're saying he likes people who praise him. I get it, Eli. Thank you. What about that, Elon Goldenberg? Is Trump, are we making this too complicated? Is he attracted to people who like him, or is he just attracted to their authoritarian style?
I actually think he has some affinity to general authoritarian style based on just his history of speaking about these things. And sometimes the way he disregards American democracy, whether it's, you know, his tweets about the courts or, you know, after the immigration bill or the immigration EO that was overturned, or commentary even this week about wanting to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate. I think he looks at how some of these other guys operate and wishes he could have that here, and he's finding out that the system of checks and balances in the United States doesn't give him the flexibility to do that. But, you know, in terms of the strategy, you know, I always tell people, don't look at what he says, look at what the administration actually does, because he's got a lot of capable people around him now, with Jim Mattis, Rex Tillerson, H.R. McMaster, and others, Dina Powell. You know, the president says one thing, but then the administration seems to do something else, and you're trying to marry those two together. So you do have to analyze these things and what he says and the consequences of them, because they impact the strategy that is being pursued and driven by people who might have a more strategic perspective than he does.
Let me play this sound from yesterday's morning edition on National Public Radio. Michael Anton, the head of strategic communications for the National Security Council, said President Trump wants to put the brakes on globalization, reassert control over U.S. borders, economic policy, and tax policy. Here he is.
Allies, partners, other nations Let's say they have gotten used to America behaving in a certain way and not asserting itself in some of the ways that this president has asserted American interests. And so I think it does make them nervous. It feels to them, if not unprecedented, but like behavior they haven't seen in a long time, maybe since before World War II.
Is there some sort of scale here, Ilan Goldenberg, scale of acceptability? Are there leaders it might be better to talk with than others? You know, is it okay to, I mean, you know, there's a list here, North Korea, Philippines, Egypt, Turkey, Russia, that we haven't discussed. I mean, is there a scale of acceptability that we should be looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. These guys are all different. And some of them are traditional American partners, like Turkey, Egypt, and the Philippines. You're going to have to find ways to work with them, and you should. And I'd actually agree with Ambassador Jeffrey that our Egypt policy in the Obama administration leered too far into human rights without actually being effective and ultimately burned our relationship with Sisi. And Egypt is a key stabilizer in the Middle East and somebody in need, not just for countering terrorism. On the other hand, and look, I would even argue in the right, you should be negotiating with North Korea. I would not be offering up a presidential meeting with Kim Jong-un. And also, more so, I would not be praising him. There is absolutely zero strategic benefit in my mind to praising what is possibly the most repressive regime in the world, an enemy of the United States, one that has nuclear weapons and is threatening all of Asia. There, I see absolutely zero benefit. And so this is where I think you got to distinguish. I think, you know, for the president, it might just be an overall approach to praising these guys who he can relate to or finds appealing in some way. But the consequences in each case are different for our strategy and for those trying to, implement strategy below the president. So that's how I would think about it. You know, I sort of think about two criteria. How repressive is this government? And also, what is its relationship to the United States? And so put those two things together and try to get, based on that, some kind of a measure for how complimentary, how nice, and how much access you're actually going to be offering these.
Let's get Matthew in here from Detroit, Michigan. Matthew, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, just a couple of things. One, he's dealing with an honor and shame culture. So, but I like
honor and shame cultures. Result. Yeah.
Yes, you deal with like when you deal with people by their face, honoring them, and if you dishonor them, that would be the Middle Eastern culture. We lived in Turkey for 9.5 years, but to my point, I mean, some of the results. Wow, he got China to put pressure on North Korea. Obama didn't do any of that. You look at the results, all the things that Obama's foreign policy did create a vacuum for that. And I know you're going to say, oh, he's just regurgitating what Trump said, but it's absolutely true. And I wanted to ask the ambassador after the break to give us what, when you talk about we deal with results, what are some of the results you've seen? And of course, Obama left us, we were the tail. And it's just, I saw the impact of Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, and it's frustrating to see these brutal dictators, but he's got to establish relationships so we can actually barter and do something with them.
Matthew, thank you very much for the call. Ilan Goldenberg, I know we have to let you go. There's Matthew. He says things that haven't been working. To your mind, what are the consequences of this type of rhetoric or Trump's personal style in general?
Sure. In terms of consequences, I would say that the biggest one is, you know, this uncertainty that we've talked about that he's created across the globe, this shaking up of the system. You know, that can work well with certain adversaries of ours. You know, you sort of want to keep countries like North Korea, Russia, and China a little bit on edge. But you know, you also need your allies, you need your European partners, you need people who count on you. And I think he's pretty much made everybody feel uncomfortable and unsure. And that's bad when one of the strengths that the United States has is its ability to lead this international alliance system that it's had since World War II.
Ilan Goldenberg, Director of the Middle East Security. I'm sorry to interrupt. We have to go to break. I do appreciate you being with us today and appreciate your perspective. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important.
Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about President Trump's penchant for praising dictators and despots, as he's been doing lately. You can join the conversation. Is this just Trump's approach to foreign policy? Is this what you want to see from the leader of the free world? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest this hour is Susan Glasser, the chief international affairs correspondent, a columnist for Politico. She also hosts the weekly podcast, The Global Politico, and Ambassador James Jeffrey, a career diplomat who served as the U.S. ambassador in Turkey during the Bush and Obama administrations. He was later the ambassador in Iraq from 2010 to 2012. I want to play these two bits here. New York Congressman Elliot Engel, the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, telling MSNBC on Tuesday that President Trump was wrong to invite Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte to the White House.
There have been thousands upon thousands of people killed in the Philippines, and the President Duterte is encouraging it. I don't think that we want to be a part of that. It's like when you sleep with dogs, you get fleas.
And here's Arizona Republican Senator John McCain criticizing President Trump for praising North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in an interview with MSNBC's Morning Joe. This is yesterday morning.
I don't understand it, and I don't think that the president appreciates the fact that when he says things like that, it helps the credibility and the prestige of this really outrageous strongman. You know, the largest gulag left on Earth is in North Korea, and we all know about their human rights abuses.
We're hearing a lot from both sides of the aisle on this issue. Susan Glasser, jump back in here. There was Congressman Elliot Engel, Senator John McCain. I'm curious what the response is to all of this from our traditional allies and partners around the world.
Well, look, I've been listening to this conversation as it's unfolded here, and in many ways you have Ambassador Jeffrey representing, you know, one very sort of traditional pragmatism, realpolitik view of the world. We shouldn't do it because it's not effective, and our goal is to be effective, not to change other countries from within. On the other side, you have many of the Democrats you've quoted speaking out forcefully, saying, absolutely not, this is throwing away our principles in the world, and without our principles, what kind of an American foreign policy do we have after all? I guess what I would observe is that it's not clear that this is a strategy on Donald Trump's part as much as it's a foreign policy. And this gets to your question about our allies around the world. If it is a strategy, no one knows what Donald Trump's foreign policy is. And so it's very hard to say that this is part of a grand strategic vision for how he's going to reset America's view in the world. To the extent he had a strategic vision of foreign policy that he laid out on the campaign trail, it was not this one. It was about America first. And it was about basically taking a more restrained posture in the world in order to focus on American priorities here at home. And to a different extent, and certainly with different rhetorical emphasis, by the way, that was President Obama's foreign policy view as well. It was interesting to hear Ambassador Jeffrey criticize him correctly, it seems to me, for the lack of success in trying to figure out a way to influence what's going on inside of Egypt these last few years. But at the same time, actually, many human rights advocates, many Democrats were disappointed in President Obama for not emphasizing human rights more in his presidency. And in many ways, actually, he was sort of a Democratic Party version of a realist when it came to some of his foreign policy decision making. Right now, I think allies around the world, I just spent last week in Europe, are really confused. They don't know what America's foreign policy is anymore. And by the way, talking about human rights being a model, saying that there is something to aspire to and that we hope to lead something called the West, has been a pillar of American foreign policy in terms of both its messaging and in terms of some of its priorities for the last many decades, ever since the Cold War and even after the Cold War's end. That's been a pillar of our foreign policy. So I do think it's I would beware of people who say President Trump has a foreign policy doctrine and that this is part of some grand strategic design. Because right now, if no one can say what your policy is, then in fact, arguably, you don't really have one yet.
So, Ambassador Jeffrey, to Susan's point there, with regard to foreign policy, if we have allies that are confused about where we stand, I mean, where does that take us?
Allies that are confused is always a bad thing, and Susan is right. And that's why much of what Donald Trump says is then corrected by people like Nikki Haley or General Mattis or Rex Tillerson. It still is somewhat disconcerting. But here's the problem. I don't know where Susan was in Europe, but I know Germany very well. And nobody is holier than thou on standing up for international rights than the Germans, because they have very little else that they can play in international affairs. Yet nobody has played a bigger role in opening up Europe's gas markets to Vladimir Putin. At the same time as the Trump administration, the first time up to bat, denied a license to Exxon to work with the Russians in the Black Sea. So again, you look at the results, not necessarily the rhetoric. If we could have better rhetoric, I'd love it. But whether it's domestic or foreign policy, this is the guy that we knew about a year and 6 months ago, and this is the guy we've got.
We've been talking about President Trump's interactions, his praise of leaders from North Korea to the Philippines, his invitation for many of these leaders, Egypt, Turkey, to come to the White House. I wanted to play this historical clip. This is February 28th, 2016. Then-candidate Donald Trump retweeted a quote attributed to the 20th century Italian fascist dictator Benito Mussolini. NBC's Chuck Todd asked Trump about it later that day on Meet the Press. Here's that.
Do you respect Putin?
I do respect him.
Do you? Why?
I respect a lot of people, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. He's a leader of his country. I say it's better to get along with Russia than not. And if Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS, which is a major fight, and Islamic terrorism all over the world.
Right.
Major fight. That's a good thing. Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
Obviously, that was the interview with Bill O'Reilly speaking about Vladimir Putin. Here's that tweet and the questioning from Chuck Todd about Mussolini.
It is better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep. That's a famous Mussolini quote. You retweeted it. Do you like the quote? Did you know it was
sure.
Mussolini?
It's okay to know it's Mussolini. Look, Mussolini was Mussolini. It's okay to know. It's a very good quote. It's a very interesting quote. And I know it. I saw it. I saw what, and I know who said it. But what difference does it make, whether it's Mussolini or somebody else? It's certainly a very interesting quote.
Susan Glasser, there was Mussolini. We heard Vladimir Putin before that. You know, Senate Intelligence Committee hearings right now underway on the Russia probe, FBI Director Comey testifying. I mean, talk about Vladimir Putin and his relationship with Donald Trump and how all of this plays into that.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, you know, what difference does it make? It's Mussolini. You know, can you imagine the president of the United States quoting Hitler or Stalin and saying, what difference does it make? It's an interesting quote. Look, Vladimir Putin, big news came out yesterday, which is they had a phone call. It was their first phone call between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump since Trump's Syria missile strike, which angered the Russians, their proxy Bashar Assad in Syria, of course. It was their first conversation. They agreed to have their first face-to-face meeting, by the way, in early July. It will be much anticipated. And interestingly enough, it was the Kremlin press service that told us that, not the U.S. taxpayer-funded White House. Now, what does it mean? Putin and Trump have expressed this admiration and interest in each other. Both of them have looked early on for some sort of a grand bargain, a deal that eluded Trump's predecessors, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, even Bill Clinton, in terms of finding a long-term way to get along with Russia. Now, people feel Trump has veered in the other direction. But I think it's important to pay attention to what Trump actually says. And I think in that vein, it's very notable that even with all the tough words that were exchanged after the Syria missile strike, Trump never personally criticized Vladimir Putin. He's refrained from doing so. That killer's quote, obviously, is one that's gotten the most attention. But mm-hmm. at every turn, politically, it would have been more advantageous for Donald Trump actually to disavow Vladimir Putin, to say, no, he's a bad guy. Trump has never done so. He's been pretty consistent in that when given every opportunity. So I think that's significant. I think tactically, he's pivoted towards other issues because he's seen, because of the political climate here in Washington, full-scale frenzy over Russiagate, the FBI investigation, were there entanglements between the Trump campaign and Russia? Given all of that political surround sound, he obviously has seen that it's politically difficult, if not impossible, right now for him to achieve this sort of grand bargain he initially envisioned with Vladimir Putin. But I think that Trump has not given up on this as a goal of his. He's just shown that he's a very tactical, whether it was businessman or now president. He wants to get a deal done, any deal. He wants it to be huge, big, gigantic. And so if that means he'll focus on Middle East peace for a little while because that seems more congenial than Russia, then I think he'll do that. He's hosting today at the White House the Palestinian Authority's leader, Mahmoud Abbas. It's their first in-person meeting. Trump has made it clear he would love to see himself as the grand Middle East peacemaker where his previous presidents were not able to accomplish this.
Let's go to Tim in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Tim. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How you doing?
Good.
I think, pardon the easy pun, but we're not on point here at all. I mean, people are saying intelligent, well thought things about the situations in question, the despots, the mm-hmm. political situations here, the political situations there.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, we are talking about the most profoundly, staggeringly ignorant human being that has ever been in public office, at least in the 70 years I've been on Earth. This is a person whose entire value system is based on what glorifies him, money, and power. This person, obviously, when he opens his mouth, anyone with even the slightest ability to discern or slightest intuitive capabilities knows as soon as he opens his mouth, whenever he opens his mouth, that what comes out is the first thing that comes to his head. This is not a person. This is not a human being that should even be in public office.
Tim, I got your message, and I appreciate you calling there from Nashville. So strong feelings there from Tim. Let's go to Bonnie in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Bonnie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted your panel to talk a little bit about the money involved here. I think it's obvious to everyone Trump's penchant for dictators because he would like to do that. But when we talk about his congratulatory information to Turkey and to the Philippines, and to China, Trump has businesses in every one of those that he's getting plenty of money from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to keep that in mind, regardless of whatever strategy or whatever he's talking about.
Bonnie, thank you. I'm going to turn to, let's see, Susan Glasser, you respond to that. I mean, this is back to the old Trump's conflict of interest story, right? I mean, how does all of this, the invitations, the praise for these countries, their leaders, how does that play into Trump's own personal interest?
Well, look, I mean, you know, the very short answer is we don't know. And that in and of itself is the problem. We are discussing whether the president of the United States has a business conflict of interest potentially in his foreign policy. That is such an extraordinary thing. And going back to the heated opinions expressed by the previous caller, look, I think that people are realizing the extent to which Trump is improvising here. He doesn't have a deep knowledge about these places. And I think the business question suggests something that we've seen overall, which is if you want to know what Trump's ideology is, you know, it can be summed up in one word, which is Trump. And that means that he cares about what he himself cares about. And I think that, to me, has been the decoder ring so far in trying to understand what would otherwise be very contradictory foreign policy moves, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, and I've spoken with a number of people who've spent a lot of time with Trump on this question, and they've come away believing he wants to make a deal, any deal, that might be as much of a Trump doctrine as these more conventional things. We here in Washington, we have think tanks, we have policy people, we have people like Ambassador Jeffrey who've spent a whole career dealing with the facts, dealing with nuances of global diplomacy. That is not influencing Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not talking about whether he's a realist in the conventional Henry Kissinger sense of the word or his view of how to block Vladimir Putin in a complicated banking maneuver. He is thinking about Trump when he thinks about foreign policy. And I do think that if you're looking for a decoder ring in these confusing times, I would suggest that that's the way to understand Trump and foreign policy.
Ambassador James Jeffrey, you get the last word here in about a minute that we have left. What's at stake in all this? I mean, we've had this conversation about embracing dictators, expressing admiration for them. What can go right? What can go wrong with this style, Trump style of foreign policy?
Obviously, it's troubling, but it is what it is. I'm on record since last summer on how unqualified I think candidate Trump was to be president for exactly the reasons that we've heard for the last hour. The point is, he is president. How should we, in the media, in the commentariat, the think tank world, deal with this? Criticizing what Trump has been for 70 years isn't going to work. What can work is looking at what comes out of this machine. Take Russia. We've got a continuation of Obama's policies, sanctions, moving NATO troops to the east to contain Russia, and more aggressive actions, hitting a Syrian base that was chock full of Russian troops and blocking Exxon from working with Russia in the Black Sea. That's the only basis that we can take this guy on. Look at the results and then measure the results against American interests. If he falls short and his administration falls short, hold him accountable. But if we go after all of his musings and tweets, it's just going to be an endless cycle of he said, we said.
Ambassador James Jeffrey, former ambassador to Iraq, to Turkey, among other things. Really appreciate your time today, Ambassador. Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Glasser, Chief International Affairs Columnist for Politico, host of the weekly podcast, The Global Politico. Really appreciate your time and perspective, Susan. Thank you.
Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.